Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Monroe Live podcast. For those of you who maybe just joined for the first time, Monroe is a company that does lean design, design for manufacturing, cost avoidance support to like new product design. And I'm Kevin Hardy. And today we have Dave Tracy. So of all the people that I've talked to here so far, this is the only person that I actually kind of know.
So you can't blow this one.
No, Kevin. Hopefully not. So
you got a friendship on the line.
Yeah. So Dave and I met probably 6 or 7 years ago off-roading. He knew of essentially the Monroe Knowledge Center that we center that we ran for Chrysler at the time. He was an engineer at FCA, then made the transition. Sure, I think you had already done it when we met to Jalopnik. And then
you by the way, when we met off-roading, you were driving this enormous like diesel GM Cuckvee, I think you call
yes.
it.
This. Yeah. And commercial utility cargo vehicle. Yeah.
We were trying to get it through the woods. This was an off-road trail through the woods in northern Michigan, and it was just spotting. That's all it was. It was barely off-roading. It was like tree avoidance is what it was.
Yes. And unfortunately, I think you needed tools. That's how we met for your sway bar disconnect. And then we started chatting. And then I pulled you out once and then I got stuck and then you pulled me out and then I slid into a rock on one of the Black Diamond trails and I dented the only good rocker panel on that because the driver's side was rusty a little bit.
Well, you got to even up the rocker panels. You know, I mean, one 100%. Nice one. But yeah, it was crazy to meet you off-roading because I had already hung out at, I knew who you were because I had worked at Chrysler and I was a, fledgling engineer and they would send engineers over to you guys to benchmark. I remember I was looking at like a Ford Explorer, like a power transfer unit or like a rear drive module, something for mm-hmm. their all-wheel drive system. And you just have a bunch of, a bunch of parts on racks. And I remember, actually, I got in trouble because of you guys. Yeah, you guys got me in trouble. I borrowed a part. It was I think it was the PTU for an Explorer or something. I borrowed it as an intern. So, and then I left for the summer. And I could have sworn I turned it back in. Well, I leave for the summer. I get hired on full time. And they're like, yo, Dave, where's that PTU? You borrowed it from Monroe. You never gave it back. I was like, I don't know. Anyway, they weren't thrilled with that.
Yeah, and it wasn't even our part, technically. So that's probably why they weren't thrilled with it. So, but yeah, so we have some history. You want to start by kind of, I mean, you've made kind of a series of moves, since then, if you want to kind of go to a brief backstory, kind of what's brought to you essentially to LA and the Utopia.
No one likes that I moved to LA. I don't know. There's just like this. Yeah. So for the longest time, I mean, I've loved cars since I was a kid and I always wanted to work at Chrysler because I was a Jeep. I was really into Jeeps. I grew up in an Army family. And when we moved to the States, my dad bought a Jeep Grand Cherokee. The first generation with solid front and rear axles. And, I have five brothers. So it was six boys in Kansas. We didn't have anything to do. We had a Jeep. So you know what we did. We just sure. offered the crap out of it. In the Missouri River floodplains right there on Fort Leavenworth. Yeah. We got stuck we got stuck so often that if we weren't home by like 10:30, my mom would know what happened. Like it wasn't, she would literally be like, you guys are stuck again. Like
the MPs are looking for you on range control or,
Well, the MPs have actually, they actually had to like come, assist us, not like pull us out or anything, but you're not really supposed to be back there. But anyway, so off-roading with my brothers in Kansas, that really made me fall in love with Jeeps. Because, I mean, this Grand Cherokee was a tank. You could really beat on it. It had a 4-liter straight six. You couldn't kill it. So if you do enough of that, and you have enough like joyful moments with a car, it's hard not to fall in love with it. And if you're a kid trying to figure out, hey, what do I do with my life? And you're just like, just enamored by this machine. Like for me, it was like, I got to work a Jeep. I just want to do it. And so I'm going to study engineering. Went to college in Virginia, somehow got lucky enough to get hired into Chrysler as an intern. And then came on full time in the JL program doing cooling system design, which, by the way, timing couldn't have been better because I didn't want to work on like the Compass or whatever.
Sure.
But like as soon as I got there, right as I graduated college, 2013, I get to Chrysler and they're like, we're starting the new JL program. I was like, you waited for me. It was perfect. And then the craziest thing is we had a team. Our team was small. It was the Advanced Aerothermal team. And there were five of us. And the manager of our team, Brian Lee's greatest manager ever. He ended up becoming the chief engineer for the JL. He asked the five of us, so we have all these programs people are working on. We've got the minivan, you know, we have the DT Ram, we have the KL and the K, whatever. We have all these cars. Who wants what? And I was like, looking around, I was like, we're all going to like jump after the Viper and the Wrangler, right? Like we're all going to fight. We're going to fight for those two. And everybody else was like, I don't care. I'll just take whatever. It doesn't matter. And that's when I realized like, one of the disappointing things about working in the auto industry, like especially if you move to Detroit for the auto industry, you assume that if you work for a car company, everyone there is obsessed
into cars. Yeah,
not they have to be.
Not at all.
No. They work for an automaker. How can they possibly not be obsessed? It turns out locals need jobs, and it's that simple. So anyway, I was able to choose. I literally chose the JL Wrangler program, the Viper. I remember I was amped about the Viper. I went down to the guy who had sort of led cooling system design on previous Vipers. I'm like, let's do this new Viper. He's like, oh yeah, the Viper's dead. And I was like, damn. So I didn't get to do anything on that. But I was on the Wrangler program for a couple years. And then I got an offer from a friend I met in college who happened to run my favorite car website, Jalopnik, at the time. And that was Matt Hardigree. Car journalism for me was like sort of a pipe dream because like, honestly, I don't think you should go to school assuming you're going to get a job in car journalism. There's like three jobs available. It's like, doesn't make a ton of sense. And I knew that. And I was like, plus I want to work for Jeep. So I'm going to study engineering. It's a good degree to get, versatile. The journalism thing, maybe I can like freelance every now and then. But I just happened to end up being like basically neighbors with the editor in chief of Jalopnik. And we became friends and, you know, he ultimately asked me to be an intern at Jalopnik during my senior year. He and I met because I was running a car club and I wanted to like get him on to do like a keynote speech to get interest in the car club. So eventually I was there at Chrysler. He offered me a job at, by the way, going from engineering to journalism, people think you're insane. Like I remember leaving Chrysler and everybody's like, dude, are you sure about this? Why would you? Literally people were like, why would you do this? Engineering is better than that. Like, engineering here, media here. And I was like, to me, it's like, it seems fun. You get to drive cars. Sure. You get to write about cars. You get to interview great people. You get to get interviewed by great people like yourself, Kevin. And it's like, I thought it was just great. And I was young. I didn't have any obligations. So I was like, let's do it. And so I worked at Jalopnik doing like buyer's guides, which is like the worst possible job you could have. But on the side, I was wrenching on really cheap cars because I'm a cheap bastard, to be honest. So I bought a $600 Jeep Cherokee and I did a whole project and I tore down, I hydrolocked one of my Jeeps while off-roading and I tore down that engine. And people started to read that. And so the editor-in-chief of Jalopnik was like, all right, stop doing buyer's guides, start writing for us. And
right.
So I did that for a while, and then a couple of years ago, I was like, all right, I've been at Jalopnik for 5-6 years. I've had a great time with it, and now I wanted to start my own site.
Sure.
And so now the Autopian was born,
right?
Just about 2 years ago, this coming April. So That's where I, that was way too long of an intro. I really blew
it. No, it's fine. No, it's fine. what's funny is before we met, I knew where you lived inadvertently because of the pile of Jeeps in Rochester Road. As soon as once we met and you're like, oh, I live here. I'm like, I know exactly where you live. Literally, yes. Exactly. I know the exact house.
People knew where I lived when I wrote for Jalopnik. So that's like 5 years and I'm just buying all these cheap cars, like a $500 Chevy Tracker and like a $800 Grand Wagoneer that I basically dug out of a backyard. I'm buying these. The reason why I buy these cheap cars, one, they're cheap and I can afford, you know, they don't cost anything. I really want to own one and I can't afford a nice one. And I don't have any obligations, no wife, kids, dog, whatever. And most importantly, readers goad you. Like if you write about something, they read it. They're like, they want more.
Sure.
Next thing you know, you got 14 cars in your backyard, which I did. There's a video on YouTube where I jokingly like explain that I'm not a hoarder. But I had 14 cars at one point on Rochester Road in Troy. So if you don't know Michigan, Troy is like not a, it's like a nice part of town.
Sure.
Like it's, I lived in an old 1946, like little farmhouse that I was renting. It was the only, it was one of two like leftover farmhouses on a street that's basically filled with nice condos and like mansions.
Right.
And so I had, here's this dude who's paying like $850 a month for rent. Has 14 cars, 10 of them in his backyard, one like basically buried. And the neighbor is in like a, you know, almost, a, you know, probably at least $500,000 house. It was kind of weird, but it was like, it stuck out like a sore thumb to the point where like readers would come over because they knew where I lived.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. I lived off of Rochester Road close to, oh God, was it 16 Mile? When I moved to Michigan, because I stayed with my friend at this house before I ended up taking over the lease, I couldn't believe that there was exit 69 on Big Beaver, and there was a Hooters at the corner. I'm like, this can't be real. This
right
literally
there.
Cannot be real.
Yep. They were selling T-shirts.
Yeah,
and you would see exit 69, Big Beaver Road. People had a lot of fun with that.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it was a real thing. So yeah, I think, right there, not far. So
yeah, but that is a thing of the past because
it is
because the construction. It's like I don't know exit whatever now.
But yeah. So anything else do you want to kind of add to or you know?
Way too long of an introduction.
No, that's fine.
We cannot continue. We can't. Let's move on.
One of the things that we hadn't talked in a while, and we ran into each other at the auto show and kind of had, I would argue, a preliminary conversation about this in some regards. But
it was a beautiful moment.
Yeah. PHEVs, hybrids, BEVs. I mean, right now, and today is, what is it, the 23rd of February? I mean, my news feed is all doom and gloom and on my work computer because it's essentially just war in Ukraine, EVs, bad. End of EVs, mistakes, GM, you know, double backing on things, volume cuts. It's just, that's all it is like financial woes and things of that nature. And we have this conversation here about cost all the time around these vehicles. I can't speak for everyone here, but there's various opinions on what people like about HEVs, PHEVs, BEVs, the cost about them, complexity about them, manufacturing them, you know, pluses and minuses, you know, and things of that nature. So, so it's always been a hot topic here and, it's become a very hot topic just in general, right? Because we've seen impressive movement, you know, I've been kind of in the conversations here, been equating it kind of like the Star Wars trilogy. When we saw the Model Y just gaining market share, you know, that was like a new hope. Right. And then we saw, I think a lot of policies and things put in place. And then I think right now we're at revenge of the market, where some of those things do not jive with, you know, reality in many ways and the market coupled with the simple fact of the matter is we've obviously just got out of a global pandemic. There's a war in Ukraine.
Now, that was 4 years ago.
I know it's just wild. War in Ukraine. We have another major war in the Middle East. There's lots of geopolitical positioning between the West and the East and just all sorts of things, you know, and inadvertently this directly affects, you know, car manufacturing in many, many ways. you know, on the purchasing side of the house, it's always interesting to see negotiations, where things are going for labor, things like that going into the future and the troubles. And it's kind of like a good indicator. And it's there's a lot of turmoil there. There's always turmoil. But I think the last 10 years have just been a tough time for the auto industry in general, for all number of things. Quality, performance, safety.
But at the same EVs, time, there was a time where sales were like booming, like mm-hmm. during the, like right after the pandemic. Like people, like it seemed like things were great, like there for a minute.
It's interesting. So, like, let's just start with like PHEVs. Like you think they're not good enough here, like within the States.
Yeah. So for reference, this is a story that I wrote on the Autopian, which that's our website. It is a car enthusiast focused site. If you love cars, that's like what we do. And every Sunday I write like an opinion piece. And a couple Sundays ago I wrote, America's plug-in hybrids are not good enough. And it was basically, so I drive a BMW i3 every day. And if you drive that car, in my view, at least, you realize just how great that like setup is. It's fantastic. I have a 22 kilowatt hour battery and mm-hmm. I drive electric only like 99% of the time. Like you can give someone a car with a battery that's not that big. And obviously, you know, battery supply is an issue and cost is an issue. Right. So if you can get someone driving electric the like vast majority of the time with a small battery, that's an ideal case. And you can really only do that with a range extended plug-in hybrid. Mm-hmm. But America's plug-in hybrids today are they're really gas cars first and EV second. Sure. Whereas like the plug-in, like the i3 is an EV first. And if you have to run it on the range extender, you begrudgingly you do it. But I mean, a lot of the plug-in hybrids today, I mean, the Wrangler is like what gets like 25 miles of range, something like that.
Yep.
And that's obviously a brick, but there are a number of like more aerodynamic cars that are, you know, 30, 31 miles of range. And there are a number of issues with that because, you know, some people can commute to work every day, but people have concerns about a lot of plug-in hybrid owners just don't plug in.
Sure.
And, like if you're driving on a road trip, like why would you plug in a car to get 25 miles? Like, let me just stop, you know, fuel up and plug in to get to, there's no point in doing it. But if you've got a car that has like, in the case of my i3, 70, 80 miles of range, it might be worth it. Like if you have a reasonable range on a plug-in hybrid, I think it's like between 50 to, you know, 120, something like that. That's your range. And then you've got a little gas engine. You're going to focus on driving electric.
True.
There's incentive to do it. And you don't have to have a huge battery. You could still drive electric most of the time. And I think just as important, you know, it's not necessarily just about the numbers. It's not just about, okay, well, if you do that, the emissions are going to be this and the cost. A lot of it's like getting people into a BEV like some people are just still skeptical about it.
Sure.
Like there's a skepticism that wouldn't necessarily exist if you said, look, you still got a gas engine in this thing. You could get someone who is extremely skeptical towards EVs driving electric 99% of the time if you would offer them a car like this, which Ram is doing, by the way, with their new Ram
Charger.
Ram Charger, which, by the way, what do you think about that new Ram Charger?
It's interesting. It seems like the epitome of like excess. You know, it's a huge battery with a Pentastar generator. Yeah, I mean,
Isn't it huge? The thing is, you're right. It's a huge battery, but it's also less than like it's like half of the size of the fully electric. See, the problem is, if you want to tow, you have to have 200 kilowatt hours of battery.
Sure, and that's it's a weird realization. You know, many CEOs have kind of spoken to it. And honestly, frankly, I'm tired of like even reading anything or people talking about towing with EVs. Like years ago, people knew that it wouldn't be great, and nothing has changed drastically with respect to that. To go back to my Star Wars analogy, when Return of the Jedi happens, I don't know when that is, right? But ultimately it comes down to essentially battery cost per kilowatt hour, right? To get these things down, and that obviously will only benefit not only BEVs, because I think EVs, regardless, even if carbon emissions were never part of it, in some ways make sense from just like
an engineering standpoint.
Yeah, an engineering standpoint, yeah. Like a life standpoint. Like, it's kind of nice. You can just plug them in.
They're awesome.
There's, I mean, there's a lot of benefits to them. So I think even if there was never, if you know, and maybe we'll get there with the Porsche, you know, e-fuel. If it was just hopes and dreams and butterflies that ICE cars burned, I think eventually we would still trend that way just because of the integration of electronics into everybody's life. You know, we're probably not too far out from just, you know, electronic implants and it just being cyberpunk with respect to the human body. So it makes sense that we would trend this way with automobiles just in general.
I do agree. I think we would eventually be EV just by the very nature of how they drive. If I have a gas car in my garage, and so I do, there's a gas car and then there's the i3. If I grab a set of keys without just like really making an actual decision, if I just instinctively grab a set of keys, it will be the i3 every time. And that's just because in my brain, I know it's just quiet. It just feels, you're not starting an engine. There's like a comfort. It just feels right. It is. There's just not as much going on. It just it's a better driving experience. So I mean, obviously I'm a huge ICE fan. I love a stick shift and all that as well. But like, you can't drive an EV and not realize this, something about this feels like just right from an engineering standpoint, you know?
Yeah, I think they have, like I said, I think we would have gotten there anyway, right? Yeah. For lots of reasons. I just think that the biggest issue that's facing everyone now is there's a lot of market factors there, you know, that's driving costs up, even though we just had like a pretty big plunge in lithium price, you know, recently. So even all of our numbers that we have now, if we were to, we probably want to rerun some in the future, but it's interesting. And there's, in the background, there's tons of capacity coming online. So for better or worse, you know, there was this push that there's a singular solution, at least in the automotive space, from a carbon emission, and it's battery electric vehicles, right? So in the background, there's tons of plants coming online, and domestically, abroad, pretty much everywhere. Significant, you know, investigation on, you know, minerals and things of that nature, because even if it wasn't cars, it would be something else, right? Cell phones, other electronic devices. Nothing is using less energy, and needing less battery capacity. So, but as far as, you know, the PHEV aspect, you know, I don't know if you want to kind of talk about like park complexity or things of that nature. Yes. But it's interesting to me, like, you know,
Monroe, I don't know your opinion. Tell me. I feel like you have an opinion, but like, what do you think about PHEVs? Like, just tell us what you really
sure
think.
So I mean, obviously I'm one person here, but there's a group of us that feels that PHEVs probably got skipped over. Like, initially I was very much like, too much complexity. Especially when some of the PHEVs that we tore down very early on, you know, Lexus LC500, which was painful because they don't make many of those cars. And, kind of like,
those are cool.
They're very neat. They're very, very cool. And very, very well put together. The interior, like, nothing moved, like very high quality fasteners everywhere. It was a disaster from that perspective because they didn't have they didn't heat stake anything, which is commonplace because they just didn't invest. It's like essentially built by hand, right? They're just a guy running in with a nut runner for door panels.
As a customer, no heat stakes for me, that's a deal breaker.
Yeah.
First thing I look for.
Yeah. Yeah. And who can fix it, right? But it was kind of a shame to tear apart. And you can tell anybody that came down that was, you know, JDM fans were just like, this is wrong. You should not be doing any other Toyota product or Lexus product, not this one. But there's a lot to be learned from it. The customer that was interested in it, you know, for some of their other stuff. So, but it was, you know, modules. You could tell, right? It was supplier based, you know, OBC charger, just modules picked together, placed wherever you could fit them, because obviously the other powertrain was a V8, right? And when you see that, you couldn't help but think of just the problem sets from both powertrains, right? Oh, valve issues, oil changes, everything that can go wrong in an ICE car can go wrong in this one, and everything that can go wrong in an EV. And I think part of the problem is, you know, maybe when the whole industry shifted very, very hard to EVs, I think even in the background, and, you know, there's lots of stuff coming for these new PHEVs that are just kind of like around the corner, with significantly more integration, you know, inverters, onto transmissions with the P2 motor and stuff like that. So things that have been consolidated to get away from essentially this kind of piecemeal approach. But I do think they make a lot of sense, especially if with limited capacity, right? We've talked a little bit about it. There is lots of capacity expanding, but in the world, especially in the North American, you know, car market, the realities of emissions, and there's some, you know, there's many that would argue that emission standards kind of got us into this predicament with the size of vehicles and the class of vehicles and test weight classes and things of that nature. But the reality is we're here. And then for every mile per gallon that you could get better on an F-150 or Silverado or Ram or their SUV counterparts are pretty big in terms of total, you know, carbon emissions. So I think it, there's a lot to be said. And, you know, Toyota has kind of been on their own little soapbox for a long time about this, that they didn't feel that it made a lot of logistics sense to have like a 200 or 150 or 130 kilowatt pack stuck into one BEV when you could essentially hybridize
three cars for that.
More than, you know, if you're talking Hummer, yeah, you know, level packs, 200 kilowatt packs, or even like the Rivian, right? You know,
yeah.
Well, 10 vehicles, right? And not, you said you're with roughly the, you know, the same capacity that you have in your i3. So not insignificant electric capability. The downside to them is if, you know, if we were to go through and start like grouping cost, right, as you go through, you know, there's still a big delta between PHEV and BEV. But when you kind of look through it, it's right where you expect it to be. Right?
What is that delta?
I have some numbers that I smashed together, which are like an amalgamation, yeah, right? So they're high level and they're kind of, I don't want to say they're purposely misleading, but, and also because of the lithium stuff, the prices have changed. But I think it's probably safe to say between the range of like five, depends, right? We'll say roughly a 15 to 20 kilowatt PHEV to like maybe an 80 kilowatt BEV. Let's just stick with like $6,000 to $9,000, right? Like delta between the two. But if you were to go through the majority of it, it's the battery. Because once you're in the PHEV, and now it's even more to like an ICE vehicle, because essentially you have your, you know, OBC charger. So that's a line item. Poof. And it doesn't get that much more expensive for BEV in comparison to a PHEV. There is obviously capacity when you're depending on, you know, what type of system you have. But you have it when you go there, right? And then if you were to go down, then the next line item, and in general, you kind of have like your big engine systems bucket for an ICE. So alternator, your whole 12-volt system.
Yep.
Alternator, water pump. Sometimes on these PHEVs, it makes sense for them to be electric. You know this, but there's this whole plethora of essentially support systems for an ICE engine: fuel tank, carbon canister, things of that nature, which is like kind of another big bucket, $1,500-ish plus dollars, depending on what you're looking at or size.
I mean, you've got just a transmission at this point,
right?
Too.
And that doesn't even exist like on the BEV itself. You know, high voltage lines are probably roughly comparable. They get more, right? You know, especially if you're running like an all-wheel drive setup where you have high voltage going from front all the way to the rear.
You got one on your compressor. Well, actually, you'd have to have an electric compressor anyway on a PHEV, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I mean, why would you not? When you kind of get through that. So when you make the plunge into PHEV, you're really not close, but you've gotten into a series of major cost drivers. Mm-hmm. Of a BEV, which is the downside of a PHEV, right? Because then you also have the major cost driver of like an ICE vehicle. So let's say for like this imaginary vehicle, we'll say it's like a midsize, you know, truck PHEV, right? Doesn't mm-hmm. really exist yet. Towards like an imaginary midsize, well, not really, there's a Rivian, but like not that type of capability, you know, kind of scaled back. But you're talking probably somewhere in the realm of today's price is like $4,000+ for like, let's say a direct injected V6 dual overhead cam, you know, motor, right? Probably comparable price, another big line item, probably another $4,000+ if we were to do like tip of the spear, like highly integrated, let's say six speed, eight speed transmission, big, maybe 100, 120 kilowatt motor, in the trans integrated, you know, kind of the next on the cusp, if you will, you know, transmission, then you have transfer case. So there's things there that you kind of go through, but there's interesting aspects where you're starting to break up separate line items, you know, that the ICE vehicle has, which is, you know, expensive, like probably $1,100 bucks, let's say, for a nice advanced, like four-wheel drive auto transfer case. Then you're probably $500 or so for front axle.
IFS, I mean, honestly, you know, but you could ditch all that if you just, if you had a range extender, right? You're just using it as a generator.
I guess it depends on your, I'm assuming like a, if we're mid-sized truck, longitudinally oriented, you know, and if you could, like if you were to essentially partition this out and do a front wheel drive based vehicle, you know, and just have electric power to the rear, you can essentially start omitting aspects of this. Mm-hmm. But essentially, I guess there, in short, there's no getting around the high voltage battery pack cost.
Yep.
And that's the biggest driver. And, you know, we're kind of talking like functional systems as you kind of go across. And then, you know, the Teslas are not like uncompetitive in terms of weight, but some of these vehicles get extremely heavy very quick. And then unfortunately, weight begets weight in terms of cost.
Yeah, right.
So totally. If I'm trying to perform well in all regulatory requirements and third party requirements like IIHS, those, you know, sometimes do not jive well for cost and efficiency of like a vehicle, just based off of where your body structure monuments want to be and how you want to support everything that gets a person to move around versus protecting a person off of a barrier impact or a particular style of impact. And like the heavier it gets, the more weight you have to add or more creative you need to get in terms of cost or materials to protect the occupants. So that's kind of the downside when you start either for PHEVs or BEVs adding weight. And I think if we talk about, you know, off-roading and EVs, I think there's an interesting thing that I've been noticing on that side as well, right? From traction perspective, especially when it gets slippery.
Yep.
Tons of Rivians and early images of Cybertrucks, just lots of things sliding in low traction considerations where that would not, you'd never see that with a Suzuki Samurai, right? It would just plow through because it's light. And there's something to be said for just your overall mass. But so in short, I know I kind of said a lot. I think there's a lot of merit to PHEVs, especially like a well-integrated one. I think that's the biggest thing is not everyone's there yet. I'm not sure even where some of these companies are with respect to them, because you're kind of seeing people double back and recant on statements with respect to where they're going for future powertrains. But I think it makes sense for a lot of people given kind of just the current environment and the cost of batteries.
I love BEVs, and obviously most of your listeners and viewers are huge, obviously full electric, not huge PHEV fans. I get it. That's totally fine. But the thing is, I don't think it's necessarily about it's not necessarily solely about, the emissions of a BEV versus the emissions of a PHEV. There are some realities that sort of go beyond those numbers. And those realities are battery supply, and just human beings' skepticism towards making that plunge, which is a reality. I mean,
sure.
There are people for whom
rational or not, right?
I think it, you know, most usually irrational, but there are a lot of people for whom a PHEV is a more palatable option. And if you can get that person driving essentially electric every day versus them continuing to drive their truck, there's value in that. I'm not saying it's rational, but humans are irrational actors.
Sure.
So on that front alone, PHEVs make a ton of sense. Add in supply limitations for battery materials, and it makes a lot of sense. You add in cost concerns, and then, you know, these become especially significant factors when you're talking about people who like want to tow a boat, you know, they now can drive around in a 90 kilowatt hour Ram with a range extender up front instead of a 200 plus kilowatt hour, which, by the way, they would be carrying around usually probably 120 kilowatt hours of battery that they do not use. Probably 95% of their driving, probably just carrying around just tons of weight and money and, materials. It's like, anyway, you know, it's a tricky thing, but I think it's going to need to be a blend, and I think people are coming around to that.
Yeah, I mean, it's just sometimes you just can't escape, right? And like I said, revenge of the market, I think. And one thing that was really, I was just in Canada very recently, and I thought something was very interesting. Like, there's a lot of solar, and we weren't that far kind of in like London area. A lot of windmills, and I was doing some cold weather training with the Canadian Army. And one thing I thought was very interesting is on their post, they had a motor pool, and every stall of this particular motor pool had EV chargers. And there not one EV was there that I saw. Granted, they could have been out driving around. It was nothing but Mercedes, Army, G-Wagons, Ford Power Strokes, and things of that nature, right? And I thought it was kind of interesting to me where we have, I think, not supported, I think, the auto industry well, right, with respect to this. We are holding them to this standard with in terms of emissions and things of that nature, but we haven't done, I think, enough as a company. If we're going to do that as a country, we haven't done enough on the infrastructure side. I just thought it was very interesting to me that I'm looking at this parking lot. There's all this charging capability right there. None of it was being used. It was almost the inverse of what I would say we have here in some regards.
Wow.
And then when you talk, I got a chance to talk to some of them. Just the cold weather fighting the cold weather is a completely different ballgame, right? You have a lot of diesel vehicles down here. Then they start transitioning to gas vehicles as they go farther north. And then it's just like, yeah, you're on foot. And you just, they have snowmobiles and things of that nature, but it's a whole separate ball game. And, you know, with the officers in this course from the Canadian, he had a Model 3. And I asked him, he's like, it's great. It's fine. We don't live that far north where it's really a major issue. As most Canadians actually live pretty close to, you know, the U.S. border. Yeah. But he's like, but it's everything when you start getting cold. And obviously, I think that's kind of what started a lot of this, at least on the media craze, was that cold snap. And then it just kind of cascaded from there with respect to
range
performance, yeah, things happening, and infrastructure, right?
By the way, none of that was like new information. It was just, it was a little silly. All right, we have a couple of other topics that I sort of mentioned that would be, I would love to talk about.
Sure.
But before I get to that, there's one thing that I've noticed as a car journalist working with automakers and driving their cars and interviewing their engineers. And I think there, on some level, there's just going to have to be a reality, an understanding among automakers that Tesla is an anomaly in some ways. You can't necessarily replicate what Tesla has done. Mm-hmm. You can't come out with an SUV. Like a lot of automakers, hey, let's just come out with an electric SUV. It'll sell like crazy. Look at the Model Y is selling like crazy. It doesn't work that way. I just drove the new Fisker Ocean, which I, believe it or not, you may have seen that a lot of people had an issue. I kind of dig it. I actually think it's special. It looks cool. It's fun to drive. The thing about it is you can't just come out with a compelling electric SUV and expect it to do what a Tesla Model Y does, or same thing with a sedan and a Model S. Tesla is first. That's part of it. Second, they're larger than life. They are like, the brand is bolstered by this person who is larger than life. Sure. And it's like, if you're a brand and you think you can replicate based on Tesla's numbers, that is not going to happen. And I think like a lot of these stories about, EV sales are not what they were expected to be or whatever. It's like, I don't know. There needs to be a reality that on some level, Tesla is Tesla.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we've talked to a lot of OEMs. For anyone that's heard me say this again, I apologize. But like, you know, and they want to know, right, about the gigacastings and some things that Tesla does, and where is the difference, right? And what can they do to emulate them in a positive sense, right? And I think the simple fact of the matter is, one thing that's really interesting is, like, think of your time at FCA, right? How FCA is organized, and just the sheer number of platforms that they have. And then look at Tesla, right? It's essentially like 2.5-ish, now 3 with the Cybertruck, yep, right? Model S, and I wouldn't say they're very similar. They're not. Model S, Model X, Model 3, Model Y. There are people, you know, people that you and I knew, right, that were responsible for twice that amount of vehicles.
Oh, yeah, totally.
By themselves. So there's a whole organizational structure thing that I think that you know, people don't give, I think, big auto enough credit for, because they're essentially managing things at scale that Tesla still doesn't, right? As far as like portfolios and they also care in some ways about things that Tesla doesn't care about, right? Like they don't care if you get the same, they didn't even care like the Model Y with the gigacastings. Maybe you got a 4860 pack with gigacastings. Maybe you didn't. No one knew. The fact that we got one, like we had a lot of our customers come to us in some ways only because we had one, right? Because they had bought two or three Teslas from Austin and they didn't have a gigacasting. So that's wild. Where, I mean, think of like some big change on like a Rubicon, right? Where they're like, that can't happen as a running change. Well, we would never, they'd never stand for it that my Rubicon had this amount of content and yours had something different from a whole slew of reasons, right? Just from your order guide alone, right? But they don't care.
Yeah.
They don't care. And a lot of the people that like their stuff, they look at it more as software as it's updating. They just see it's like, yeah, it's continual progress. That's kind of what we expected, you know?
I like that. I like that side of what Tesla does, that sort of continual change. You know who does that like at a level that I don't even think Tesla does is Chinese automakers.
I don't have a good sense, even though we have one sitting here. But that is a... That is an interesting question, right, in general. I'd love to hear your take on anything from the China EV perspective.
So I drove some in Germany. Aura, Funky Cat. I drove a Maxus, minivan MPV. I drove an iWays U6. And I spoke with some of their representatives there in Germany. And there was kind of like a braggy nature towards the conversation. It was like, I was like, so we were talking about competing with established automakers there in Germany. One of the representatives for one of the Chinese car companies said, oh yeah, they can't compete with us. They're not even our competition. They're like, they're not even competitive. We're the only competitors are the other Chinese automakers. And I was like, what do you mean by that? And one of them showed me a rear wiper on their car. They're like, see that rear wiper right there? We came out with our car. Some customers said, hey, why doesn't this car have a rear wiper? And like within 6 months, it was part of the, you know, within less than 6 months, we had a rear wiper, like you could buy it. Like it was now part of the car. They're like, we make changes so fast. And I don't know if, you know, I pulled that out of my behind, but,
sure.
But they're like, we make changes so quickly. Like that doesn't happen with Western automakers. And so, yeah, now things are getting really weird in Europe with Chinese automakers. It's like, okay, honestly, the whole story of the Chinese automakers and Western car companies, it's kind of a fascinating story because you probably remember like 10 years ago, all the automakers like, yo, we're making so much bread in China. It's ridiculous. It's the biggest freaking market. We're just cha-ching. The cash register is just clicking. Gold coins, bills everywhere. And well, part of that was like, hey, if you want to sell cars here, you have to be part of a joint venture.
Yes.
And which is kind of freaking genius. I mean, if we're being real. And now, and I'm not saying that China didn't know how to build cars before Western automakers started building cars there.
They do now.
But I am saying is they know how to build cars after all of those joint ventures from those automakers who were talking about how much bread they were making in China. And now those automakers in China are going to the home of the Western automakers, Volkswagen, going straight to Germany, competing, out-competing in some ways. Those very automakers, it's crazy. It's kind of insane in some ways.
Yeah, I think it's – in many ways, I think we have a series of layers of insulation from, I think, the problem that Europe has with Chinese EVs. But the whole thing is wild. Like even, you know, over various – like the last 5 years or so, you know, we have – a slew of different customers, some who build in China, some who want to build in China. And if you talk to them, like, I think the biggest issue is, and maybe this might be coming home to roost for them, is the cost difference, right? Everything is subsidized significantly in China. There's no, like you're saying, it was all partnerships. And I think a lot of people, if they didn't realize, if you're going to China and you get, sure, you're getting like amazing labor rates, machine rates, and things of that nature. And sometimes, you know, like, the best that the world has to offer inside as far as like, you know, capability at prices that you'll never find anywhere else, to include even like, you know, Mexico, which some people have hailed in the past as like the next great low cost, you know, bastion, if you will, for the automotive industry. It's, and the numbers, none of them make any sense. Like there's, when you look at some of the, like an identical part that's made in Mexico or here or other places in the world compared to the, that same part in China, it's like,
and you would know because you literally do that for a living.
Yeah. It's unfeasible sometimes. Right. And there's always like different commercial things that happen, you know, that may affect material piece. I don't want to say material piece price, but piece price. So there's always commercial side of things, or negotiations are always a little weird. But there's that factor. And it, to me, it's almost like the Tesla factor. When people talk about it, I'm like, yeah, they can iterate. But when it comes to value, they're like worth as much as the rest of the industry together, right? So when it comes to like, if they want to make a decision about tooling or not tooling, they're like, how much money does it save us? Well, it theoretically could save us this. Or like, I want three parallel efforts to investigate it. And as they fall off, just... and then consolidate those efforts and go forward and find me the right one, right? Not every company can do that. They don't have that type of money, you know, to leverage or whatever it is. So it's very interesting to see. But that for us, I think the only thing is we've done some things for better or for worse on like the protectionist side as far as EV incentives.
And some people in the media have sort of decried those efforts, saying, you know, cheap electric cars from China get more people driving electric, and so that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think it's the problem with this conversation. Like, unfortunately, most conversations nowadays, there's a lot of nuance, and it's real easy. It gets political fast.
So moving on.
Yeah, moving on. Yeah. So, but it. Oh, I lost my train of thought. But when you let's see, EVs.
Getting cheap EVs in the U.S. get more people.
Well, one of the big things is, like, our safety regulations here, just like I have a friend who does used to work for Volkswagen, and when they would go, you know, to Deutschland and talk about the U.S. market, they hated our market. They hated the warranty claims. They hated the safety stuff. Like, there's the emissions. You know, there's so many things, because essentially we were just like China was to a lot of the domestic automakers, this huge market that if you don't play in, you might be losing in many, many ways, right?
Yeah.
But all of our requirements are very stringent from emissions and safety, right? You know, bringing cars from the JDM market here, 25 years, and then you bring them over, and even bringing them over is an issue. There's a whole K car thing, which is funny because they are small and relatively efficient, but kind of death traps and whatnot. So, but there's that aspect, which is very interesting. So we do have that layer of protection aside from what we are offering in terms of like tax incentives, crash and things of that nature. So not that they can't do it. They can. It's just one more hurdle, you know, to get through, because when you try to build a global vehicle, it gets a little difficult if you're trying to have a global architecture to meet all the different needs of various markets. And the US market is pretty stringent. And I don't want to say it's like peak like automotive experience here, but like the epitome of first world problems exist here. People complain about a lot of things here, right? So if their vehicles aren't just the way they need to be, there's a lot of issues on the warranty side, where I think in other countries, they bought it. As long as it works, it's okay, you know?
It's a tough market, no doubt.
It's a tough market. And so from that perspective, like, can you launch and put a windshield wiper on a vehicle in 6 months? Yeah. Could anyone do it? I think so. Would the big three do it? Or it's two, because really Chrysler is now huge with Stellantis, but probably not, because of the risk.
Yeah.
They'd want to want a full durability. And tell me, right, from your perspective, right, I want to make an airbox change. You want to change an airbox. You tell me how long it takes.
There's no
if you're going to make a running change, you know.
Forget about it. That has so many implications on everything.
Exactly. So
forget it.
And that is there. And I think that's why Tesla moves fast, because they may or may not have the legacy, I want to say pitfalls or knowledge, right? Yeah. They don't have the issue, whatever that was. Like, our wiring gauge at this length in the harness will be this and supported X amount of times. Well, why do we have these design requirements? Well, you know, in 1980, this happened.
Yes.
And it'll never happen again. And
yes, totally.
So
I remember at Chrysler, we having those conversations with, say, so that this CS routing thing that we do, you know, the sort of routing requirements, like, What are those? You ask the people who are implementing them, who are, doing the CAD and placing wires and all that. They're like, I don't know. It's just the process. You know, we just follow it. It's just been there forever. And it's like, well, yeah.
It's like a weird culture. You have no idea why, but that's why we do it. Right. And, mm-hmm. and some of that is, I think why they're struggling, because there's whole layers of that domestically, I guess, with EVs of cost, right? Just some of these things burden you down the line, and you get in this area where you struggle with cost avoidance, and you're designed into this area where you have requirements that either put you on an island, and that may have been very, very purpose, right? Like trail rated, or, right. there's marketing slogans built around this, like a rock, built for tough, whatever it is. There's things that have actual requirements behind them, because for these vehicles, it's I don't want to say it's why they exist, but it may be why they are so successful, and at least people kind of hang their hat on it, and they won't challenge those requirements. Where you have someone that comes in and, we know for a fact that for some of our customers, like Teslas, don't meet their internal requirements. But does it mean it's a bad vehicle?
Of course, no. It doesn't work that way.
And it's vice versa, right? Their main competitor in a segment may not pass their requirements.
You have to always challenge your internal requirements. Always challenge them. Like, does the customer care? And like, that's something that I remember those conversations at Chrysler. Sitting down around the tables, and we'd be trying to design to some standard. And, some senior manager might say, okay, but does the customer care here? Because if not, we should reconsider the standard. And it's like, you're dealing with thousands of standards that you have to maybe reevaluate. It's like pretty wild.
Sure. Yeah. And I don't know. So I think to your point about the Chinese EVs, I think a lot of our companies here could do it. I think they won't because of the risk, both from a recall perspective, which that's the other thing that in my newsfeed. It's like war, EVs bad. And someone has recalled another 150,000 to a million vehicles for some reason. It's just nonstop, right? Because I think just in general, the industry is struggling. But
by the way, those Chinese vehicles that I drove were incredible. Like the ones that I drove in, and I also drove an MG. The technology was great. They were like monitoring my state, whether I was, drowsy. The interiors were, other American cars do that too, but like the interiors were loud, like blue, white, red in there. They were like, they weren't just boring cars that happened to be electric. They were like going for it, they were special cars. Like they were legitimately cool.
Well, I think Kia's done that well. Kia Hyundai, right?
That's true.
They pulled a lot of designers from Audi and things of that nature. They have like the kind of the things that make Toyotas like desirable, right? There's nothing fancy about a Kia Telluride. It is an all steel body, steel subframe, steel control arms, naturally aspirated V6. I think a 6-speed transmission. Nothing fancy at all. And then where you can touch things in the interior, it's nice. And then from a style perspective, it's very handsome. Obviously, styling's subjective, but I think it's a good looking vehicle, and it's affordable, and people like it. Does it go through the Rubicon Trail? No. Does it do a lot of these other things? No. It depends on what type of like how you're evaluating it. Does it do things as well as a Grand Cherokee or a Ford Explorer? No.
See, this is the thing that I always, as a car journalist, people always ask me for car advice. The one thing that has been true, that is irrefutable, automobile purchases are irrational. And if you try to rationalize them, you're just going to go crazy. People buy into a sort of vibe, like what is this car? How does it represent me? How does it make me feel? It's styling. It's marketing. It's some of its performance, but a lot of that is like, hey, I read this review on Motor Trend, and this car outperformed everything. It's the best. Some of its performance, which is a sort of a rational thing. But a lot of it is just totally irrational. Mm-hmm. It's at the point now where if someone asks me for advice, like, hey, I really like this car. I'm like, if you really like that car, you're probably going to ignore what I say you should buy and buy it anyway. So just buy that car.
Yeah, it's tough. And I think you probably saw it there. A lot of our customers and a lot of the engineers there in some ways, and it's hard not to do it. You design vehicles for yourself. You know the ins and outs of them. You know what you kind of like, what you'd like to see. And many reviews, I've heard senior managers talk about it, and like, the Toyota RAV4 is all the car you need. And we never can deal with that fact. We over-content, and we struggle with recalls, and we struggle with this. And do we offer more to our customer in every like metric possible? Yes. But sometimes all they care about is something that starts, drives, and goes 300,000 miles. And yeah. It may be irrational. Like, and I would say the value oftentimes, the value stream associated with Toyotas is maybe a little irrational because they're yeah. I have a love-hate relationship with them. I think that like in some ways they're amazing, but I think for your dollar amount, you don't get a ton of car in comparison to other things, but you and do.
Not usually the most advanced. Either. Yeah.
But it's arguable that you get a relatively trouble-free existence with them. Everyone has problems. They have their own issues, but.
Yeah. And I will say to the listener, if you want to read about a $500 Toyota Sienna minivan that I purchased and drove across the country, it was trouble free. It was fantastic. So that one definitely lived up to the hype. Yeah. Also, speaking of things that we've written about recently, I was wondering if you saw that story by Hubert about the Tesla Model S's steering rack.
Yes. I think sourced by Land Rover.
Yeah. So yeah. Hubert Mies writes for us. He was head of suspension design for the Model S, and he talked about a salute. Basically, they were trying to find a steering rack. Turns out steering racks are expensive to tool up. So they were like, we have to find something on the market that will work with our suspension design. And they found a Land Rover Evoque right-hand drive steering rack. They inverted it and they built special brackets for it. So the Tesla Model S steering rack is an inverted Land Rover Evoque steering rack.
Right.
Right-hand drive. And I was wondering if you've seen, I'm sure in your role, have you seen clever cross brand like use of parts? Maybe that's unconventional.
I think it is unconventional, but not in the space I think that you're kind of talking about, right? So that's their second vehicle, the first one being the Roadster, which was a Lotus that was been, you know, repurposed. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that's very common to see with vehicles like that, like your Fiskars and things. Well, because they're expensive. There's no getting around it, right? You know, yeah. Rivian knows this very well, right? Like building vehicles is very expensive. I think it's no different than kit cars, you know, factory five stuff. It's like a 95 Mustang steering rack with, steering totally. Knuckles from this, pulled from this.
It's just funny to think of Tesla as that kind of company, but it was, you know, in what, 2010 or whatever.
Yep. So I think it's very common to see that. And then you'll see obviously just joint ventures or lasting like past arrangements. It's funny when you see, you know, certain British vehicles, you go through them and you're like, wow, Famoco, right? And it's years after the part, yeah. right? And you're like, all right. Or under one heat shield, you go in there and there's a Ford part number, right? So I would say it's pretty much an indication of the maturity of your company and your product. I think ideally you want to control as much as you can. But because of the cost on the capital side, buying stuff like that is well suited. You're going to pay for a little bit in the piece price or maybe not. Right. Some of these, you know, volume is a tricky thing, you know, in the industry. Maybe you can talk to some people and, you know, maybe Land Rover was like, they wanted to scale back capacity and then they were going to get charged money because the supplier's like, you told us that you were going to build 200,000 of these over this amount of time and we're going to charge you cancellation costs. So now they maybe, you know, would love, someone said like, hey, we'd like to buy a steering rack. You're like, absolutely. How many do you want? We'll give you 50,000 of them a year. No problem for this price because they don't want to pay, you know, I'm not saying this happens a lot, but the reality of the industry is, you know, commercial agreements get people into, you know, they're legally binding. You're going to build X amount for this amount of time. You provide them to me at this timing iteration. If you don't, then I have to shut a plant down. We're going to have a conversation if I have to shut a plant down over a lack of parts. Right. So, or if I have to slow production down on my most profitable vehicle or popular one at this time. And, you know, I'm not hitting whatever X amount of jobs an hour. There's a conversation there. So, that whole thing is weird. But not uncommon. I think it's just an indication of the state of a vehicle.
Yeah. I thought it was, clever that they, or different, like using a common part, normal. Taking a right-hand drive rack and then turning it upside down to make it work for yours. I mean, I think it's pretty great.
Sure.
I mean, it's pretty great. Okay. One thing we're gonna talk about off-roading EVs.
Sure.
We'll have to be very brief here, but so I'm planning on starting an EV conversion of a World War II Jeep using Nissan Leaf parts, which is going to be a nightmare. But that I'm going to keep the entire drivetrain, the transfer case,
okay,
just the full drivetrain. And it makes me think about, and the plan is to try to take it through the Rubicon Trail. This is going to be a multi-year adventure, I bet. It makes me think about having off-roaded a number of EVs that have come out, like the Rivian R1T, and then seeing recent Cybertruck off-road videos. And the way that they behave, it seems a little bit different than what I am used to as sure. an avid off-roader. So like the R1T was interesting because it's a four-motor EV. So you're going over a rocky trail, and one tire loses traction. You know, there's a certain amount of juice going to that motor. And so it has to quickly react. And to try to emulate a locker with these four motors, I don't know if it's that challenging or what, but Rivian wasn't able to do it when I drove the truck. It was a lot of the tires were flaring up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you would lose traction and it would flare, it'd speed up really fast, and then eventually they'd pull it, which is not good. You don't want your high tangential velocities on your tires when you're off-roading. That can throw rocks all over the place, could help make you lose control. There is like this control associated with a fully locked four-wheel drive system where basically the tangential velocity of your tire is more or less the speed of the vehicle.
Sure.
And so that, like when driving the R1T, I noticed, man, that's something that they can't quite get exactly dialed in, like a mechanically locked system. And then, you know, you saw the recent Cybertruck off-road videos where it was sort of spinning up a tire and not trying to get up this rock. And I just wanted to know your thoughts as a fellow off-roader and an EV expert.
Well, EV expert, their expert just gets,
well, yeah. Well,
I know. We just joked about it here. People are like, you guys are experts in this.
You know what? When I was like 1 year at Chrysler, I was there for like less than a year, and I was handling the MGU, like the motor generator yep. unit for the JL. I remember a company email going to our supplier. I think it was Continental. Our company's two MGU experts, David and Zeph. I was like, holy shit. No. I cannot believe they think I am the expert on MGU for the company. I've been here for like 9 months.
Sure. Anyway. Well, if there's no one else that knows more than
I know, that is the definition of expertise.
100%. It's relative. EVs and off-roading. So I think anything performance and vehicles starts with tires, right? There's like a fight here at Monroe. There's like team BF Goodrich KO2s and team Goodyear Duratrack.
Duratrack, man. Same year.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there we go.
There's no question in my mind. So if they want to pay for my tires, it'd be great. Because I have literally 116,000 miles on my tires. Right now. And I'm still at like 7:30 seconds of tread. I'm going to push it for another year, I think.
How is that even possible?
I do 5 tire rotations. So I rotate the spare in like your standard Jeep tire rotation every oil change. So I'm pretty diligent about it. And I think they're good. They're expensive, right? But I'm a Duratrack guy for sure. I wish I had some of the data. Our mutual friend John had data that Chrysler had on it. And he's like, they're expensive. That's why we didn't go with them on a lot of vehicles, but they're good tires, especially for trucks. And when you see, to me, when you look out in the Pacific Northwest, I see a lot of Duratracks. Like in when it gets a lot of, it's like tough country and there's weather, it's a good tire for everything. The only thing it doesn't do well is they're noisy, they take weight, and they're expensive. But
it's a good thing that you said that last thing was starting to sound like a commercial.
Yeah. I mean,
quickly brought in, they're noisy, all sorts of, they got problems.
But if you got 35s, you don't want, send them my way. But, I think that's one of the first things there is tires, especially because these vehicles
are so range, like obsessed.
But they're so powerful. You know, my the Cuckfee, right? The first thing, that thing made 150 horsepower, maybe 280 foot-pounds, maybe. I don't even know what a naturally aspirated 6.2 diesel is. It had 308 gears in it. It didn't want to move anywhere, and it was the best thing off-road. It made just enough torque to just keep itself moving. It never upset itself.
That's great.
It had a mechanical locker and good tires, so it went everywhere.
That's great.
And that got me out of essentially manual off-roading. But I think its tires is the first thing, first and foremost. And then I just think there's no getting around the weight and contact patch aspect. So that the tire, the style and size of the tire,
yeah,
and the weight, and then the conditions. They seem to do very well, you know, in your normal, like, you know, like slick rock and stuff like that. They have, if long as they have traction, they're fine. But I think, unfortunately, the weight, and if they lose traction very quick, things seem to me to go literally sideways with them very, very quickly. So yeah. It just, I've never seen, it's almost like landslides that happen where you have the, just everything kind of leave with the vehicle and they just kind of skid down hills. It's very interesting. I mean, I've had it happen to me, but not in the same circumstances. So that's the only thing I find very interesting about off-roading. And I have zero, to be frank, off-road EV experience. I didn't get to go with the Rivian or anything like that. But that's just what I've noticed in a lot of the videos that I have watched with them. So,
yeah, I have a friend who does, like, you know, off-road EV development stuff. And I don't think people realize how complicated it is, you know, compared to an ICE car where it's just mechanically connected. You know, it's like pretty straightforward. Like you were saying, like you got a rear locker and you've got enough, you know, force at the contact patch, you know, via gearing. Like you have enough low end torque and crawl ratio when you have a locker, it's going to be smooth. Like your off-road experience is going to be smooth. And it obviously starts with tires. If you have bad tires, you'll be sliding all over the place. With the Rivian, I think some of that was tires, no question. You know, huge wheels, you know, like, you know. But then part of it is just like, once you lose traction, if you're locked up, mechanically connected, it's not a big deal. Like with an ICE with lockers, okay, you lost grip. Your vehicle doesn't even know, like, doesn't really even care. It's still going nice and slowly. You'll eventually gradually get up the obstacle. With the Rivian, it was like, we lost grip. Oh, we're spinning up so fast. Oh, we got to stop it. Spin this one up. Oh, it's just, there's so much going on. It's all, you know, it's all logic, you know, in a controller. It's all got to be coded in. It's a little more complicated, you know, when you've got independent, like your drivetrains are independent, and it's like, it's tricky.
Yeah. I don't think, like, you know, if you had a Lightning, right, that's just a dual motor setup, single motor. Yep. And it's got a locker in the rear, right? So
it's fine. And honestly, that'll probably be good enough.
And, you know, it is interesting. Everything about off-roading and EVs is interesting because you're really talking about a use case of it's like humans being in space. It doesn't really want to be there because you're so far away from the charging infrastructure. And
that's a good point.
It's difficult to kind of carry that with you. But I have watched this guy that they leveled and threw, like, essentially Raptor takeoffs on a Lightning, and they had some interesting experiences. Like, obviously it lost range, no surprise. But in the mountains, it was like relatively range neutral. It was getting cold and they were losing capacity overnight, but they were able to do a lot of regen, you know, while kind of essentially bebopping around the trails up and down the mountains. And
EVs like low speed. I'm curious about, like, the off-road effects on range, because a lot of people assume when you're off-roading, the range is going to be terrible. But I'm like, how different is it than city driving?
Yeah, I don't have a lot of, I just don't have a lot of time anymore to follow it. But it was something I keenly was paying attention to because I was kind of hoping that, like, there would be an e-expedition shortly after the Lightning for the wife, you know. But yeah. But it's interesting because that's the whole use case, right? Just everything about it is a little bit different, especially because the single highest dollar value item of your vehicle is also the most exposed for some of these situations.
Absolutely. So, yeah.
And I think you won't have that with your Willys, right? If it's just, you'll have weight higher in the vehicle than your average EV will. But
yeah.
So, I want to respect your time. So we've gone a little over. is there anything else you wanted to kind of, you know, add, kind of speak to?
No, just that it's always wonderful talking with you, Kevin, and with Monroe. I've been hanging out with Monroe folks for like a decade now at this point. And one of the, you know, honestly, some of my career I kind of owe to Monroe in a roundabout way, because when I first got to Jalopnik, so when I started my journalism career, I remember thinking about Monroe and I was like, what a fascinating company that was to the average person. Like once you're in the engineering world, you see cool things and you're just like, that's just is what it is. And you sort of don't realize how cool they are. But I, for some reason, remember I became a journalist and one of the, probably like really one of the first things that came to my mind when it came to like cool things that I can teach someone who hasn't been in the auto industry was, yo, Monroe, they benchmarking other automakers, looking at like the tiniest parts, like really tearing them down. It's not only is it like visually fascinating, which ended up helping my article, of course, but like what you do, the costing, like truly understanding cars at a level that really no one else does. That was a story that was so well read back, I think it was in maybe early 2016. People were like, holy crap, this exists. This is look at all these parts on these racks.
Yeah. I remember people thought like it wasn't legal. I was like, oh boy, everybody does it. It's like,
There's a whole
fleet of competitive vehicles.
Totally. Yeah. But people didn't even understand that element of the auto industry. No. It wasn't really talked about. Vehicle benchmarking is huge. And like that really got a lot of people thinking, oh, you could just tear someone's car down and copy it. Like, of course everyone does that. And it's, and anyway, so obviously thanks a lot for, you know, taking the time and talking with me today and just for you guys just doing cool shit.
Thank you. And for a long time, when people would ask what you do, I would just send them your article. And a lot of people here, some people are like, oh, I finally understand what we do because someone wrote about it.
What? Someone at the office?
Yeah, 100%, Jim. He's like, yeah, it's the easiest way to describe it, you know? So, I mean, like, I'm not even joking because it's what we've done over the years has changed, right? We kind of ebb and flow at the times when.
And your media now, actually, that's the thing. The last, like, you know, what, four or five years, like,
yeah,
really has become a big part of what you guys, and you guys are doing great. Well, and thanks, you know what I think? You know what I think? Your media, the explosion, it gives me hope in this world because it literally is, okay, someone knows something that I don't know. They're actual experts. I'm going to follow them. It's literally. Obviously it's your personalities and it's the way you do, you know, you execute your media as well. But a lot of it's just nobody else does this or knows this. And I want to learn. And like, that's kind of great. It's not just like little 7-second TikTok videos of like cats.
Again, I appreciate it. Hopefully we'll do this soon. This was a lot of fun and it was nice talking to you at the auto show and then the Stampede event later, you know, we didn't even like listen to it, you know, all the Ford brass is there just chatting about stuff. And we were just talking about, you know, BEVs and whatever, and just where the industry's going. So we'll have to do this again soon. And hopefully before it was fun. And
thank you so much, Kevin. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks. So I guess till next time. So thanks again, Dave. I appreciate it.
Yep, thank you.